prior to going down to Washington for the meeting with Alan Dulles, one of our correspondents raised the question with me whether I knew that our stringer in Cairo, Egypt, who had quite a bit of work recently, was actually a full-time staff member of the Office of Naval Intelligence. I hadn't heard any rumors to that effect, but when I was sitting next to Alan Dulles at dinner subsequently, later that same week, I raised the question with him. He said he didn't know anything about it, but we'd check it out. He called back a couple weeks later and said, your man doesn't work for ONI, he works for us. Well, we agreed right then that Frank Kearns, the person in question, would have to make his decision whether he wanted to work for us or for them. He eventually made the decision to go with us. I gave him a contract as a correspondent, and I'm convinced that he did sever all his ties with CIA at that time. And I think that illustrates the most important point of this whole relationship, and that is that cooperation with an agency of the government, whether it be the State Department or the Treasury Department or OSHA or anything else, is one thing, but you can't have a reporter who's working for an intelligence agency and for you at the same time. During the period of the Cold War, I think cooperating with the government of the United States was quite satisfactory. I see nothing wrong with it. But I think it's absolutely imperative that anybody who worked for a news agency work only for a news agency and not for any outside or government interests.
And I assume the CIA had similar relationships with the other networks and other news-gathering organizations?
They may have. I have no way of knowing, no evidence whatsoever. Now, there is one possibility, and that is, and I'm sure it still goes on, that if some big story breaks out in a portion of the world, some remote center of the world, where a news agency does not have its own correspondents and is so far remote that it's impossible to get a correspondent in or even a major stringer in, that they reach for anybody in that community who may be able to report, and it may be that some persons who are there will get on for a couple of broadcasts who may be there primarily for the CIA. I don't think you can avoid that. But any news agency which is in any way self-respecting will, within a very short time, have its own trusted personnel in to take over, so I don't think there's any damage done.
When you went to Time Incorporated in 1961, what were the first projects you tackled?
Well, Time had been asking me to come over from some time, and the reason was that Time had been generating quite a lot of revenue overseas. Their international editions of Life were making a lot of money. Their international editions of Time were making quite a bit. The books division was beginning to yield some substantial returns. Time had set up a company in Holland, and through the lawyer who set up the company, Peter de Brouw, they had a feeling that it might be possible, the time might be right for moving into some kind of a commercial broadcast organization in Holland. So that this was really the first priority when I got there. They wanted me to get to Holland fairly soon after getting my feet on the ground and understanding the company, to getting over there to see what the situation was and follow through as rapidly as possible. Well, I went and found out that it wasn't nearly as favorable as they apparently thought it was, that Holland is a much more complicated country than they had assumed, and that there were many tensions involved in any move toward commercial television. Also, that the group of businessmen whom they thought they would be able to join in were not quite as enthusiastic about having Time involved in it as Time had originally thought. Now, that didn't mean that we backed out of it. We did stay active, looking into Holland for another 4 or 5 years until a basic change was made in the Dutch communications law. And as a matter of fact, we got to the point where, partly because of the groups we were involved in, the Dutch government fell as a result of its television policy. But the revision of the television policy more or less screwed us out, so that was finished. In the meantime, we did have some publisher friends in Germany, publishers of the Kronische Stadtanzeiger in Cologne, who were interested in television in Germany. And we decided the best way to approach that was to set up a small film production company and have a unit in being in the event that they might eventually get a regional television license. So we set up a company we called DuMont Time, which existed for, I guess, at least 10 years and was moderately successful. The first real investment we made came in Lebanon. The Lebanese television station had been losing money, but primarily because it lacked a big, powerful transmitter on a high mountaintop, and they wanted to find some investor who'd come in and furnish enough capital to put up this high-powered, high-mountain transmitter. And I guess a number of American companies were asked. The American government was very interested in having American interests involved because they recognized the fact the French government was seriously involved and they wanted to maintain some American interest. We finally took the risk and went on in. It was an interesting opportunity. We sent an American broadcaster from Denver, Clayton Brace, over to operate as our representative in the station. When he came out, he incidentally went to San Diego as general manager of Channel 10 in San Diego, now KGTV. It was not very satisfactory, however, because the station almost, you might say, had built-in requirements to lose money. There was a certain type of inefficiency built into it, which it was almost totally impossible to overcome. We went at the end of a year point where they needed another couple million Lebanese francs, Lebanese pounds of capital. They came to us and asked for us to take our 30% share or whatever it was. The French government was not nominally an investor in it, but we found out that the 9 French companies who were investors were responsible to the French government. So that we went along once with an increase in capital and stood up to the line and paid in our share, but the next time it continued to be a loss, we said we're not doing it anymore. This time, we are not going to put up any additional capital. You're going to have to revise the whole method of operation. We're going to insist on efficiencies. Well, we couldn't get anybody to agree to these efficiencies. They continue to lose money. So it finally got to the point where they needed another infusion of capital. I went out to Beirut and sat in on the board meetings and was as cooperative as I possibly could be. But while I was there, we were also negotiating for the sale of our interest in the company. Well, before I left, we had a good solid nibble from a sheikah, which is a Mrs. Sheikh from Kuwait, and by a series of machinations, went up to London and sent a code, got word from New York that a price was acceptable, sent it back in code to Beirut. We made the deal, and that took us out of Lebanon. But in the meantime, we've made investments in South America, in Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, and almost in Peru, but not quite. We got a film production company started in Sweden, largely on the same basis as Germany, with Philips of Sweden as our partner. But that also blew up at the last minute because we ran into some political governmental opposition that really stopped that company from functioning. We were in Australia, Newcastle, and the one I really enjoyed most was Hong Kong. We had a chance to get 10% in an application for a license in Hong Kong. And there, they had enough confidence in us so that I became the chairman of the non-Hong Kong investment group. And we were in a position where our engineers made their propagation studies, deciding what kind of antennas to use, what kind of transmitters, where to place them, and the like. We looked for property and designed the building, designed the equipment, ordered the equipment, and set prices and the like. And I even hired the first manager for the company. So that one was a great success, and it's still a spectacular success from a financial point of view, and I think artistically it is.
In most of these countries, were you interested in acquiring stations or building stations, or were you more involved in program production? Or both?
Well, I think the idea originally was to take participation in stations, minority participation. We never wanted majority because we realized that the whole business of programming for television is too sensitive to justify a non-national of the country involved having the real control. We thought we have two things to offer. We have capital and we have management know-how. And we'll come in and we'll offer the capital and the management know-how, but you're in charge of the program. We'll help you with it. We'll give you certain guidelines, but we will not make the program decisions. Usually, when we went into a program production company, we did it with the thought that we might have some means of obtaining equity position in a broadcasting company at some later point.
Besides your involvement in investments for Time Incorporated, what other sorts of activities did you do for that company?
Well, I did quite a lot with programming. When I first went over, they had the idea that I could divide my time between this foreign travel and investment business and programming for television. And they thought particularly that The March of Time would make a great program series. Well, I did spend some time on it. I didn't have enough available time to be able to devote as much effort to it as I'd wished. But I don't think it would have done much good, because The March of Time by that time was seriously dated. It was, it had been done primarily before the war, in other words, during the late 1930s, and during the first part of the war, revived afterward, but not with any great success. I also discovered that, I'll say a third of it was shot by March of Time production crews, who were very good indeed in using modern techniques. But let's say about a third of it was bought from the existing newsreel companies, and another third of it was dramatic recreations. So that there wasn't really very much to which we had rights, and which at the same time was real actuality film shooting. So there wasn't much left over. Now we tried one test to see whether we could use some of that footage. Cabot Lodge, who in the meantime had left as ambassador to the UN and was on the Time staff where he'd worked years earlier, seemed to be a logical person to be a narrator, and because he remembered some of these episodes as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But the trouble is that whenever he came on, the show stopped, and when the film came on, it picked up again, and it just simply did not work. So in the meantime, I had to go overseas too much anyway to doctor it any further. But we kept on playing with it. We had this German film production company, and we planted certain ideas there and thought we might bring something back. They were a little stubborn about being flexible to our ideas and thought that it had to be done in the Teutonic way or it wouldn't work, and that didn't always fit American desires. In the meantime, I'd been under some, I can't say pressure, but there'd been requests to see what we could do. So I started haphazardly making an examination of what Time Incorporated had that could be converted into television film. Well, generally, at that time, it was pretty difficult to sell syndicated product, except game shows and reruns of I Love Lucy to American television. The 7:30 to 8 o'clock hour had not been pried loose yet as for the family hour. And I thought what we'd have to do is get an international constituency to support anything we did. So we started looking for material with an international language. Well, what goes internationally? Music does, art does, nature, science. Life magazine, or the Time Life Books Division, had just produced the Life Nature Library and the Life Science Library. So there were a couple people around, one of them, ex March of Time, who was available on sort of an ad hoc basis. So we went to work to see what we could do with those two and decided there was a first-class series. But we didn't think we could sell it to start in this country. We couldn't get enough money to pay expenses. So we started in Europe with it. We put together a European Program Committee to work with us and started to get commitments from European countries to get enough money to justify going into production. At that time, working this way, we were sure we couldn't get the American networks, and there were no syndication organizations, so we got NET, the predecessor to PBS, you might say, to put up a little money for it. So then, with NET in this country, it was easier to go back to Europe again and get stronger support, because they didn't feel they were allied with these money-grubbing American networks, which is what they regarded the American network as being. So eventually, we got the World We Live In series off the ground and going, and I think at the time it was on the air in the late 60s, early 70s, it probably was seen in more countries than any television program up to that time. And I'm sure it's paid off handsomely ever since. So that was the one successful venture. I tried some other ones. I had a feeling that with Life's Pictures, if we could find a way to animate the Life Picture files or give motion to them, we might do 3.5 to 4 minute units, which could be sold for inclusion within our television news broadcast on the local scene. But we could never bring enough people together to do the job, to really make it work, although I still think that could have been successful.
Did you spend most of your 9 years at Time Incorporated traveling around the world?
A lot of it was traveling. I was doing more than 100,000 miles a year. I remember, for example, one 3 or 4 month period, I went to France and Italy. In February, came back by way of Cologne, Germany, got back to New York, spent a weekend here, went to Australia and New Zealand, got back to New York, spent a couple of weeks here, went to Japan, Hong Kong, Sydney, Perth, Singapore, Bangkok, Athens, Rome, Bonn, Amsterdam, London, back here, and then another month or two later was on the way back to Europe again. So that...
I'm surprised you ever recovered from jet lag.
No, you go so much that you don't have much jet lag. You don't have time for it.
In negotiating Time's acquisitions of television properties in all these different countries, what sort of problems did you encounter with the governments?
Well, I think... In Western Europe, for example, the BBC theory still prevails. In other words, the BBC had set down the theory that commercial broadcasting is something which is more or less beyond the pale. You know, commercials should be tightly controlled. And I think that generally was felt to be the theory in the Western European countries, and they didn't want to go all out commercial. There was so much pressure for the sale of advertising time that all European, except Scandinavia, all European countries have permitted some sale of commercials, but rigidly controlled. Also, I think they were not at any point willing to permit private companies to intrude into television, which they regarded as a business for public corporations, but not for privately owned corporations. So, looking at it in retrospect, I don't think there was much of any chance there. Now, elsewhere in the world, there was not the degree of public capital available, public monies available, governmental monies available. They needed to have private enterprise in South America, for example, and they had the governments there were not particularly opposed at the time we went in to permitting private enterprise to develop these broadcast enterprises. There were restrictions on the currency, for example, getting currency in and out, and where you place your investments and the like, and tariffs on the importation of equipment. But generally, I think they were so interested in getting some kind of television organization going that they were willing to overlook a lot of the other restrictions. In Australia, we were caught in two ways. In the first place, the Australian government wouldn't permit us to own more than 15%, but on the other hand, the U.S. government would tax us exorbitantly if we didn't have a minimum of 15%. So we had to get to 15 and right on the level. So I finally negotiated a deal with a name which has since become popular in this country, Rupert Murdoch, or maybe unpopular in this country, to buy about 5 or 6% from him to go along with another 9% or so that we picked up from the Packer interest. But it varied from country to country, and it's dependent upon the financial condition of the country and how badly they wanted to have us in.
What prompted you to leave Time Incorporated in 1970?
Well, I guess it goes like this. In the first place, one day I had a call from a man from a publishing house who said, I want to come in and talk to you. A man from Prentice Hall, and he came in and he said, I want you to write a book. I said, where'd you get that idea? He said, Eric Severide said that you'd be the right person to write this book. I said, well, I'm pretty busy and I'm doing a lot of traveling and going here and there. And he said, well, think it over and I'll call you in a couple of weeks. And I thought it over, and by that time, it was perfectly obvious to me that this international caper that I was on was easing off very rapidly, because there just were no more areas to conquer, no more markets to go into. The film business was getting very complicated. They were just in the process of buying an instructional, educational film company that was on its own. And there were a couple other things I wanted to do entirely apart from this. So the next time Tom Lipscomb came back, I said, all right, let's sit down and talk business on the book, and I'll be prepared to take some time off and go ahead and put it together. So we talked business on it, and he came up with an advance, which was reasonable and would have financed 3 or 4 months of service. In the meantime, I had a friend at the Markle Foundation who had been looking for somebody to come in and sit in his office and give him advice from time to time on broadcast businesses, on broadcast questions. So by going to the Markle Foundation and having an office and a secretary and a telephone and a dictating machine and an advance on the book, the time seemed to be right to split with the life we've been living and do something completely different. Which I did, and I promised to have the first draft in by June 30th, and I think I delivered the first draft by June 30th.
That was The Electric Mirror.
Yeah.
But Prentice Hall didn't publish that book.
Prentice Hall didn't, because in the meantime, Tom Lipscomb left Prentice Hall and went to another publisher, but they were not interested in taking his property over. So I went to the next editor, and the next editor at Prentice Hall, and I was dissatisfied with the editors. And finally, Lipscomb, who had become chief editor at Dodd Mead, called and said, "Well, look, why don't you come on down here to Dodd Mead with him? And why don't we take it here?" So I said, "All right, we'll bring it to Dodd Mead." So Dodd Mead got it finally.
What would you say is the primary focus of The Electric Mirror?
Well, you know, that's a sad question. I can't tell you what the primary focus is, because, again, the editor really wrote the first outline on it. He gave me an outline that he wanted me to follow, and I'm afraid that in the process I deviated somewhat from his outline but followed it too closely, and as a result I never really focused it on my own, and I'm rather dissatisfied with it from that point of view. The focus was supposed to be very generally all the aspects of what influence has television had on the political process in the United States, and I suppose that's a focus, but I'd like a narrower one, and I never really got to that narrower one, which I should have.
What was the response to the book when it was first published?
Well, I think Dodd Mead had fairly high hopes for it, and they got a very negative review from the New York Review of Books, I guess primarily because it wasn't critical enough of everything in the whole process. As a consequence, I think Dodd Mead got cold feet and didn't promote it nearly as much as they would have otherwise, and whereas it picked up some fairly good reviews as it went along, they never did promote it very hard. It was awfully hard to find it in the bookstores. I guess that's the complaint every author has about his publisher, but
perhaps because you'd been the president of CBS News, they considered you a spokesman for the establishment?
I guess so, and then they looked for critical elements in the book, and I wasn't...
Or exposés or that kind of thing.
And there were no exposés.
After you finished the book, you joined Encyclopedia Britannica.
Well, while I was working on it, I had, in the meantime, gotten involved originally with the Ford Foundation, then outside the Ford Foundation, and setting up an international organization, which is now called the Institute for International Communications. Then was the International Broadcast Institute. And in the process, I'd been pestering Senator Benton for money from the Benton Foundation. And I'd known him for some years, and he lived fairly close to us in Connecticut. And finally he called me one day and said, "Come on down and have lunch with me." Incidentally, I went up to his room, his beautiful suite in the Waldorf Towers, and when he called for lunch, he called for only one instead of two, apparently forgetting I was there. But anyway, he said, "I want you to come out to Chicago and work for me. I want you to take charge of two things, the international aspect of the company and... also, conversion of any product we have to television." I said, "One thing I do is pay well. I've been making people rich all my life. I'd like to have you come out there and do this job. I think you'll like it." Well, then he kept on calling and romancing over a period of time. And finally, I was finishing up the first draft of the book. And time to go back to work doing something or other. And he made it sound so attractive, went ahead and did it.
And what sort of activities were you involved with at Encyclopedia Britannica?
Well, there were the two separate functions. One of them was trying to find out what I could do with their product for television purposes. And that wasn't very easy because they had so many of these 10, 15, 20-minute products, and they were it was awfully hard to see how you could fit them together, and it was very difficult to get at the negatives, which were hidden in the salt mines around Hutchinson, Kansas, and they were protecting them carefully. So I worked awfully hard for a while with Hollywood producers and elsewhere to see what we could come up with. We came awfully close, but never really hit it. They did once afterward along the lines that I proposed, But also, I was to watch the international business. They had wanted to do two things in the international market: beef up the volume of sales, and also establish better lines of communication for acquisition of product. So for them, too, I did quite a lot of traveling. Now, it fit in with what I was interested in, because by this time I was well along the way running this International Broadcast Institute, and I had the chance to travel into a lot of areas where I was meeting with international broadcasters of one type or another. But, you know, I was awfully close to the film peddling business, and I'm not a salesman of Peter Rabbit in 17 languages. And that part of it was not terribly interesting to me. Although, it was, you know, there were many fascinating aspects to it, and I got a good feel of how instructional film goes on the market. But I still had no desire to stay on a long-term basis. But he was right, he does pay well.
When did the offer come to join the faculty at Northwestern University?
Very shortly after I got there. I had an old friend in Chicago, Newton Minow, who had been chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, a Northwestern graduate, and teaching a course at Northwestern. And he said, "I'm going to get you entangled in Northwestern." Then Bill Cole, the dean of the Manil School, had called him a couple times. We had dinner at his home, and I met some of his people, and he and Minow agreed they were going to entrap me into it. Then once I was down in Mexico, I got back, and the two of them had had a lunch and both wanted to talk to me. And they'd had Bill McCarter, the general manager, vice president of WTTW, the public station, in, and the three of them had a plan they wanted to work out for integration of the Manil School and the public station. Well, by this time, I was getting myself trapped further and further in it. And Cole asked me to come out and do one seminar during the spring season, which I did. He arranged it so I could do it at my home in the basement. And he furnished transportation for me. So I had a seminar of about 15 or 16 graduate students. And then he started arguing that what I ought to do is come out full-time on the staff during the fall. And finally, we spent the summer, much of it, out in Aspen, Colorado, with the Aspen program on communication and society. And while we were there, it became possible for me to take over a grant to do a study on the relationship of television and politics. And Cole offered to provide secretarial services and facilities to do it. So finally, around the 1st of September, I called him and said, "Okay, you're on, starting September 15th.
That was 1975.
72.
How long were you at Northwestern, and what prompted you to leave?
Well, I was there for 3 years altogether, and it was, I think, generally quite a successful and quite a happy 3 years. I only dealt with graduate students, and in seminars, the graduate students were of an unusually high caliber. They'd been very carefully selected. I guess only about one applicant in six were accepted to the school. It was not too technically oriented, which means that I didn't have to get too deeply involved in the working in techniques. It was mostly in generalities, social science approach, you might say, with specialization in the broadcast area. I was given a lot of time to do what I wanted to, although I worked on an 8:30 to 5:30 basis every day because I had a good office and facilities. But and also I got myself locked in pretty tightly to the Chicago community and rather liked it. So that I had no particular desire to leave there, but then I got a call, in the winter of 1975, saying that my name had been proposed as the president of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, and would I permit my name to remain in the running? Well, it was rather fascinating. I know about the two organizations. Incidentally, that was two separate corporations then. I would have had two separate jobs. But I'd known about Radio Free Europe particularly since the early 1950s at the CBS, and of course I'd been offered that directorship of Radio Free Europe some years back. And it, after being on the campus for a while, I just had, that itch to get back into administration. I felt perhaps in some respects I was better running an organization than I was sitting apart sort of as a semi-scholar. And the challenge.